Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies. Watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is June 14th, 2018, and this is episode 90. Politicoast is a BC politics podcast. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you found us. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott Glenboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we check in with Jesse Woodward in Nanaimo to find out if Leonard Krogh's run for mayor of Nanaimo is going to bring down the government. It won't. We're going to look at whether Andrew Scheer is silencing Maxime Bernier's free speech. And I did a special appearance with the Marxists over on Out of Left Field to see why the NDP sucks. First up, we have a little bit of news. Hopefully you can see our new logo on our website at politicoast.ca.
And if you can't, well, this is an audio format, so you're a little out of luck on that.
In theory, it will propagate through your feed, so when you're looking at your phone, it'll hopefully be there. If not, hopefully by next week. But otherwise, thanks to Jackie Rolston for helping us put that together and the patrons who helped make that possible. You can find her work at jackiedraws.com and the link's in the show notes. We also have to thank our premier sponsors, Lindsay Tedds, and we're going to be talking to her hopefully next week about the MSP Task Force report that was just released today and also just kiboshed today by the finance minister. It's still interesting, so I think we'll get her on to talk about that. And also Blake Hodson, who helps make this show possible. And Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to get unique coverage of the BC legislature in your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate just for you. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. First up, we'll throw it over to our interview with Jesse Woodward on Leonard Krogh running for mayor of Nanaimo. Well, welcome back to the podcast, Jesse Woodward. We had you on back on episode 79 when you talked to us about the wild wackiness that is Nanaimo municipal politics. And it turns out there's been a bit of a development in the last couple of days out there.
Yeah. Well, Leonard Krogh, our local MLA, is basically announced to run for mayor for the next election. So that's been a not so well kept surprise or a secret rather in local Nanaimo politics and stuff.
And Krogh is fairly popular locally.
Yeah, Krogh is quite popular, very popular. If I remember my numbers correctly from the last election, he won by at least 2,500, 3,000 votes, which is a pretty safe margin for Nanaimo. So,
just to be clear, you're working on Krogh's team, correct?
Yeah, I was on his local constituency for the NDP, and I elected to work for him for the election, so.
Okay, so Leonard Krogh, in addition to being well-liked, has fairly deep roots in the community, or kind of what's his backstory?
Yeah, so Leonard was born in Nanaimo, but he grew up in Coombs, which is just, 15 minutes out of town, but he basically spent his university, early university years here. And then eventually after going to UBC for law, or was it UVic? They get mixed up.
No worries.
But he ended up settling back in Nanaimo where he met his wife and set up a law firm after serving some time, or articling rather, at a local law firm here. And I believe he was elected back in 94. As MLA for Parksville Ladysmith. I might have that constituency name wrong.
That sounds it's reasonable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and yeah, deep roots in the community.
Okay. And so he said he's going to remain as MLA until and if he wins the mayorship. Do you think that affects his popularity in the riding? Are people sort of a bit skeptical of that at all?
I've seen some people, and definitely people in the minority, be a little skeptical of that. But that being said, Leonard isn't going to collect on his salary once the writ drops, which I believe is coming up quite soon.
It's September, isn't it?
I believe so.
Yeah. So he gets a little bit of money for the summer, but...
Yeah.
Well, and I guess...
And we're not going to be into full campaign mode until really September anyways.
Yeah, it's only here in Vancouver where it's nonstop election mode, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess the big controversy here, or what people are trying to spin it as a controversy, and I saw even Andrew Wilkinson saying this is a terrible decision for the NDP, is this idea that, oh, if the Liberals win a by-election there, it will bring down the government. But as far as I could tell, that riding's only really not gone NDP twice in the history of it. Is that true?
Yeah, I believe it's twice in the last 50 years.
And one of those was 2001 when the NDP was basically wiped out.
Yeah, when the Liberals won everything.
Except two seats.
Yeah, the massacre.
Yeah. So do you think, though, the Greens might have any effect in that riding in a by-election?
Maybe. I don't know.
That's fair.
It's always about turnout in by-elections and stuff like that. And it depends on who's more engaged than who. And we'll be coming off the municipal election and then the referendum for proportional representation. And then who knows when the by-election is called, if and when he wins.
Yeah, just they would have 6 months. Gives them a fair bit of time to...
Horgan could call the election well within 2 months of him resigning. So you have people already engaged on a local level. That might be an edge, I guess, for the NDP.
I guess mathematically, even if the Liberals did win, the vote split in the legislature would still just be 43-43, assuming all the Greens went with the NDP in a confidence motion like they've committed to doing. And in that case, Darrell Plekis votes with the NDP and the government stays. They just can't pass any bills.
Right.
So it becomes a bit of a sticky situation. So the government would probably want to pull the plug on itself. But
It wouldn't be entirely unreasonable in that case for the lieutenant governor to decide the situation was unworkable if literally nothing could pass. But, you know, it's fairly far off. And I get the sense that the NDP is fairly popular in Nanaimo. Am I right here? Like, the chance of actually having the riding go the other way is pretty slim.
Yeah, I imagine like the Greens will probably campaign fairly hard, but I don't know where that will get them. The Liberals are still not very popular here, but you know they definitely show up and vote. When the election comes, you know that will be post referendum too. So even if an election was called, we'd be under that new system, correct?
I think by-elections were. Under most of them, we're always going to be first past the post. I actually don't know what they would do if a...
Yeah, that's a good question.
If, say, we had MMP and you had a top-up seat, I don't know how they by-election that, but I guess province-wise.
It would probably be first past the post. And either way, I don't think Elections BC can get a new system in place within 6 months.
Yeah, I think that's the bigger issue here. So
even if it passes, it can't be implemented in time.
And it would probably take a full general election before we can really put a system into place. So it'll probably still be a first past the post in Nanaimo.
Yeah, I have the feeling there's not much to worry about, too. Mm-hmm. From my understanding, there's quite a few Liberal MLAs that are past their due date for moving on into like retirement or a different level of politics or just, you know, spending time with their grandkids. There's at least three of them, from my understand, that have maxed out their pensions and, you know, just they don't have any skin in the game anymore. So you might end up with some resignations coming out of the blue just with like retirements and then people moving on to other campaigns. I can't remember. There was the Rich Coleman over on the mainland for Surrey, possibly running for mayor.
There's a rumor going around about that. I don't know how much stock to put into it.
Yeah.
Well, I guess...
You know, we'll see.
Yeah. Turning, I guess, to Nanaimo a bit more locally, since we last talked, has there been other developments besides Leonard Krogh? Like, is he going to end up running unopposed? Are there other major candidates who might block his bid?
Well, right. Yeah, I guess in terms of other mayoral candidates, there's this RCMP officer who declared much earlier in the year. And then there's also Don Hubbard, who's served on a cornucopia of boards in Nanaimo. I believe he was with the Port Authority, and he was also with the university at one time too. But he, I believe, is being framed as the more conservative candidate for Nanaimo. So,
right. Any other comments on Leonard Krogh's mayoral run before we let you go?
No, I think he has a very good chance of winning. He's the top contender. From my perspective of politics in Nanaimo, he's exactly what we need in terms of a person to rally behind.
No one's going to threaten to shoot him in the head?
No. And that person was actually formally fired in the last month, too, which was like something everybody was excited about. So
with Leonard Krogh entering Nanaimo politics, does this put the era of the craziness to an end?
Well, having been in the room and filming the live stream for the event, I definitely felt an appetite for that. And I would hope, with the right people elected, there's would be a group of people who would build that framework for Nanaimo no longer being crazy like that on a governance and administrative level.
All right, Jesse, well, maybe just close out by letting people know where they can find you, where they can find out more about Leonard's campaign if they want to get involved.
Sure. So on Twitter, it's Krogh for Mayor. It's the same handle across Facebook and Instagram, and it's krogh4mayor.ca. And then as far as I'm concerned, I'm Iconico on Twitter. And then that's I-C-O-N-O-C-O, and I'm easy to find.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for
Thank you.
On.
Have a good day, guys.
Good night.
Moving on to segment two, burning the sacred cows. So there's a little bit of drama this week in Ottawa, as it looks like the relationship between Maxime Bernier and Andrew Scheer really has soured.
The on-again, off-again Ross and Rachel situation is in the on-a-break situation. The trade war between Canada and the U.S., I think, partially precipitated this. Trump has been on about Bernier's favorite topic, which is supply management, and going, that should go as part of the negotiations, and Trudeau standing firm to the bully, saying, no, well, he was going to protect it anyway.
Yes, but now he has doubled down on the fact that Canadians should have really expensive cheese.
And in Parliament, the NDP put forward a motion saying, you know what, we're behind Trudeau, putting in the tariffs, standing up to Trump, defending Canada. Kind of just a token motion. Most of the Conservatives were on side of it as well, and all the Liberals. And I say most because it was Bernier who was like, it mentioned supply management in there, or hint alludes to it, and I don't know if I'm okay with that.
Like, in Bernier's defense, like, there's kind of a point there. Like, supply management's a pretty garbage system, and even a broken racist clock is right twice a day. And when, you know, Trump's coming out swinging against it, not entirely without merit.
Well, and Bernier also in this last week sort of re-released a chapter of his book that he said he wouldn't publish, and then he'd pulled that chapter off the publisher's website. And this is the chapter where he talks about his arguments for, which aren't really for supply management, but mostly for repealing supply management, for tearing it up. And the juicy quote in there comes on the 23rd page. So he's talking about the leadership race. He talks about this Facebook page that was set up and how members were being rallied in support of supply management. And he talks about how Andrew and other candidates were busy touring Quebec's agricultural belt, including his own riding of Beauce, to pick up support from these fake conservatives only interested in blocking my candidacy and protecting their privileges. And then he notes that most of those members haven't renewed their membership more than a year later, which is true of everyone in a leadership race. But
yeah, their retention rates are pretty low. And also, like, Andrew Scheer has not exactly been wowing the people who weren't already based conservatives.
And so this fake conservative comment comes out again, this breaking with the party on the motion to support Trudeau's retaliatory tariffs, and just generally saber-rattling about supply management when he's a shadow cabinet minister. So Scheer says, fine, you want to be making noise? Then go sit in the backbench. You're out of my cabinet, shadow cabinet. and you can just, yeah, you can go sit in the back of the room. And you have the point about people being able to make the argument about this, but there is something to be said for caucus solidarity, or at least your sort of upper leadership uniting behind.
Yeah, it's one thing to give backbenchers a little more freedom, but, you know, the front bench is kind of supposed to show a little more solidarity.
Bernier's book even says this. He says, after the vote, he told Andrew he would keep quiet on the issue. There was no point in continuing the fight, and in doing so, foment disunity within the party and show disrespect to the new leader. He talks about no legitimacy to question it, but a substantial portion of the party was behind him on this issue, and the next time an opportunity presents itself to debate it, he will resume his fight. And it looks like he has, at the cost of his shadow cabinet role.
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, you kind of got to appreciate him standing on principle on this one. But yeah, politically, it might not be the smartest move.
So he's a bit too mavericky for being, I guess, anywhere other than in charge or in the back. Is there a connection here with maybe Scheer being worried about Bernier's future leadership ambitions, since he did come so close?
Yeah, I don't think Bernier's been subtle about the fact that he wants to become leader.
And I guess the question then is, he has a big chunk of support of the party membership on behind him, who he told to support Scheer while Scheer is leader. But are those libertarian conservatives, who I guess aren't the fake conservatives, they're the real conservatives, are they going to stay satisfied, or is he going to use this to maybe start sharpening the knives?
I can't see him being able to pull any sort of leadership review or anything until after the next election. But yeah, I wouldn't surprise me if there's some sowing of dissent in the back ranks. And, you know, if or when Andrew Scheer loses the next election, which is almost certain based on the way trends are going right now, I would not be surprised if Maxime Bernier comes out and tries to unseat Andrew Scheer and will probably be successful at it.
Well, it's interesting. The trade war has actually, I've seen some people try to argue it's really good for the conservatives, but overall, the comments at the G7 where you have Trudeau versus Trump and Trump going after Trudeau, I feel like that only really benefits Trudeau.
Yeah,
like if we're dealing with domestic issues, that's where we can have differences. But once we go onto the foreign policy stage, you kind of all go, well, the prime minister is being prime ministerial.
Yeah, there's no gain here. Like, the gain for the conservatives is when the liberals bundle something internationally like India. But they're not bundling this one here, and there really isn't much daylight between the liberals and the conservatives on this. So why choose the conservatives over the liberals?
Is there a different way the conservatives could be playing this trade war? Like, is there any other position to have right now? Like, even the NDP is sort of just, yeah, what else is Trudeau going to do?
You can't attack the liberals on getting us to this position, but like, it's not a great argument. They try to make it a bit, but most Canadians will see that like Donald Trump is a little off his rocker, not exactly predictable or easy to manage. So there's an understandable thing that, you know, if we're in a trade war, you know, blame the White House, not the PMO. But yeah, ultimately, I think this is going to hurt Bernier in the short term. It's hard to be on the backbench, and this is definitely a blow for him, although it isn't the first time he's gotten demoted and been able to stage a comeback, and the last time was for a lot more serious things than sticking to your principles on a issue he's in the right on. Like, it's if you're gonna suffer a setback like that is damaging, the forgetting classified documents at your Hell's Angels affiliated girlfriend's house is a much bigger setback than thinking Canadians shouldn't be overcharged for cheese.
Especially when you're on the conservative side and you're like, yeah, why do we have a, well, what he calls a Soviet-style regime?
Well, yeah.
Like, cartel.
Yeah.
I loved in this chapter, I skimmed the chapter, and he goes on about how people were offended when he called it a cartel, like people who work in the dairy industry. And he tries to like defend himself.
Cartel members are offended when you call it a cartel. But
no, but he's trying to like emphasize that he's using like a dictionary definition of the word cartel and not the like common parlance of like mafia things, because this is a government one and the people working in it aren't killing anyone.
Yeah.
But the dictionary defines it this way. It's always a bit of a thin defense on any language. But he got it into the debate, so can't fault him for his vehemence. And we'll see how well he can do from the backbench. But right now, I think he does come off a bit petty. And the long run, it'll probably work out for him.
In the re-releasing the chapter, the book was, I think, pushes it more into the pettiness thing, because if he just left the chapter of the book off and it was all about the supply management, yeah, he'd come out looking a lot better, because he's got a valid point. It's a dumb system.
Next up, why can't the NDP win? I took some time on Tuesday night, the night after I was up late drinking for a Canby Report live show, to call in late to the Out of Left Field podcast, where I spoke with the boys out in Victoria about the Ontario election and more broadly just about literally that. Why can't the NDP win the most easy elections? We'll play a bit of that and then I'll let you throw in your thoughts, because you meant to be there and you were really trying to, but things didn't work out.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. Things came up, I wasn't able to make it, and I do wish I could have come there, because I think it would have been good to have a not just partisan perspective on it. Although, having listened to a couple episodes in preparation for this, it does sound like a few of them are of the opinion that the NDP doesn't go far enough, which is, I guess, the typical NDP
thing. Yeah, the most critical people of the NDP are New Democrats. But you can find the full discussion on the Out of Left Field podcast, which is found wherever podcasts are, or on SoundCloud, where they mostly release. So do check it out. And we'll throw that link in the show notes.
So Ian, to the topic at hand, the NDP Ontario, what was your general thoughts about the whole Ontario election debacle and Doug Ford, the walking corruption scandal of a man winning the premiership?
Oh, it's the most standard NDP story, isn't it? Your hopes get so high only to get dashed at the last second. Like, everything lined up for Horwath to finally pull it off. She finally brought forward a platform that wasn't totally just the Liberal Party light. Like, it wasn't the revolution, but she started leaning into, you know, dental care, pharma care, expanding the social safety net, taxing the rich, the stuff we want the NDP to be talking about, and they still can't do it. People hate the Liberals. People hate Doug Ford, and they just can't get past that hoop, past that line.
To be fair, it was very close. I think, I mean, in terms of popular vote, the NDP was they were, what, 5% behind the PCs or something like that?
Yeah, I have it in front of me. It was 40.5% for the PCs to 33.5%. So the polls were really close for a while, and there were a few times where the NDP was ahead in the polls, and that's where I think we all got very confident. And
well,
then,
yeah, it was like when Mulcair was flying in the polls, and then he tanked afterwards. So, yeah, it was, like you said, it was same old story.
Other NDP elections.
Deja vu all over again.
Yeah. It's, I gotta say, though, I mean, you mentioned, like, Horvath kind of presenting herself and the NDP as a liberal light, but I do remember, not the last election or the one before that in Ontario, the NDP was basically going more right-wing than the Liberals, with like this, like, we're going to have a ministry of cuts and we're going right, to find savings no matter what. And that obviously, you know, went over like a lead balloon. But I guess that's sort of getting into the meat of the question of why the NDP doesn't succeed. It's kind of hard to convince people that you're going to actually do these cool things you're suddenly talking about when your history as leader has been pretty mediocre at best.
Well, the Ontario NDP doesn't have a huge record. The record they have is pretty bad. It's Bob Rae.
Well, sure, but I mean,
you can just point out he's a Liberal now.
I was just going to say, he doesn't count. He's a Liberal.
I think they should. I think the ONDP should have just thrown him under the bus and been like, you know, yeah, it turns out he was a secret traitor all along, and
take the
like a Manchurian
the
candidate by the Liberal Party. He was brainwashed in Ottawa and sent out to destroy us.
I mean, that's what the BC NDP did to Ujjal, and I'm pretty sure they also did it to Glenn Clark. I mean, just like burn those bridges as soon as they're out.
Yeah, well, I'm sure Tom Mulcair is going to have an interesting ride in the future.
Oh,
but
he whose name shall not be spoken. Yeah.
He was, you know, Kennedy Stewart's running for mayor of Vancouver. And the first announcement he put out, this is total off topic, but was Tom Mulcair. And I just couldn't figure out why he thought that would help his chances in Vancouver.
Well, maybe because...
Like, it's not like Mulcair is hated here by the average person, but there was no big, you know, people with Mulcair signs on their back.
No.
That's a bit like starting out a sentence with, like, Tony Blair was a great prime minister of Britain, and I want to, like, continue in his legacy.
Yeah, pretty much no matter who you are. Well, I think that's one of the problems a lot of people who are, like, inside these parties have, is they seem to be under the impression that the average person cares a lot about, like, these names. Like, the average person in Vancouver will care about you talking about Tom Mulcair, even though in reality he's probably not even mentioned in NDP caucus anymore. Like, it's one of those things where I think they kind of live in a bit of a bubble where the sort of personality politics that they've been living in their whole political career matters a lot, whereas in the real world people are like, generally speaking, they'll vote on party lines or they'll vote on some kind of issue-based thing, whether it's, you know, like dental care or toll bridges or housing programs or whatever the reason is. And that ends up being important in a way that, like, I know Tom Mulcair just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all.
Well, so to bring it back to this question of why the NDP can't win, and I wanted to frame it like that. I pitched this to you guys.
Yeah.
And we're in a province with an NDP government, but...
Barely.
And live next
exactly,
to one.
Exactly. It was a tie. Even when you had Christy Clark sitting on 16 years of neoliberalism and presenting no real platform, we could barely eke out a tie. Alberta's got the only true NDP government right now. Or Alberta has the only government that was elected that is an NDP government in a majority situation, arguably because the right was fractured in half and they couldn't decide whether to go PC or Wild Rose, and the NDP snuck up the middle while everyone else looked too corrupt or wing nutty to elect.
Yeah, and I guess we'll see what happens in the upcoming Alberta provincial election, where, I mean, all signs are pointing to the NDP getting kicked out for that very reason, that the right is united again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is a bit of a problem, I suppose, but... The other question, I guess, is on the one hand, why does the NDP lose? But then also, why is the NDP the one that people end up flocking to? Because there was a Liberal Party in Alberta that was just as unlikely to win that election at the beginning as the NDP was. And similarly, in Ontario, you know, the shift to the NDP, which did happen, I think there is something to the idea that people are looking for solutions to the problems they're facing. And I guess all I could say of sort of the milquetoast Liberal parties of Canada is that they're by and large discredited and not and kind of just not really sitting on any firm level of support at all anymore.
I would say especially like in an ideological sense, because and I really am loath to reference Maclean's magazine again on this show, but
go ahead.
There was
I'll get you a subscription.
There was an article called something like the center is dead, Doug Ford is elected or something like that. Like with the collapse of the center of the support for the Liberal Party and, you know, voters going like further left and further right, respectively. I do think that's true. I do think that the, you know, ongoing post-2008 sort of slow crisis of capitalism is actually caving out the political center, and it's pushing people further left and further right as they, you know, demand actual solutions to their problems. And Christ, even Doug Ford, you know, as right wing and you know, pseudo populist though he may be, he was talking about things like ending hallway healthcare and, you know, like problems that people are facing in their actual lives. And so you know, I think that the center is unable to really inspire people and give them solutions that are actually going to fix their problems. I think that, Ian, as you mentioned already, I mean, the NDP often fall back onto this sort of centrist, liberal, diet liberal kind of position on things. And because they, you know, the NDP wants so badly for the media to respect them as much as the media respects the Liberals. And they want so badly for people to like them like they like the Liberals. And so they're like, well, like, if we just act like the Liberals, then obviously we'll get treated the same way. And that's kind of like saying, like, well, you know what? Nickelback is really popular. Why don't we make a band that sounds exactly like them, and then they'll be just as popular? It doesn't work.
Band. Make a
punk band that sounds like Nickelback to try to get people to come over to punk rock.
That is an unfair comparison to the Ontario Liberal Party, okay? That is low, even for you.
But I think that hits on the right sort of idea, or what I've been thinking about a lot is that idea you're talking about, the centrism is dead. People want bigger solutions, but it doesn't really explain why people are going for what looks, I don't know, maybe I'm just being too coastal elitist or whatever, but what looks like the obviously corrupt solution. Ford, like days before the election, it was announced his being sued by his brother or his sister-in-law, something like that, and all this other stuff is going on, all the scandals that erupted about them stealing voter information, but yet they were still able to run attack ads on the NDP nonstop saying they'll elect a bunch of activists, and that's what even John Horgan's cabinet's been accused of.
It's pretty ridiculous with him, yeah. But I will say, I think that the people who are using those attack ads on Doug Ford completely misunderstand what people are mad about and why people are supporting him. And I'd say, in all honesty, the way in which these attack ads are being transparently used for political ends is what people end up taking from it. Not that Doug Ford is screwing over his brother's widow, but that the Liberal Party was sitting on this chestnut until it was at the most opportune time to use in an election. It's very similar to the releasing of the tapes of Donald Trump during the last American presidential election, where suddenly at what the Democratic Party thought was the best moment for them to release these tapes, they were released. But I think the thing that both the Liberal Party and the Democrats in the states are misunderstanding is that people don't trust the media. And they think that when these things happen, it's basically a conspiracy to try to undermine a candidate that's just trying to do the best for whoever. And so, and in a sense, they're kind of right in that if this information was actually an issue that the people who are talking about it care about, it would have been released well before the elections happened. We'd have heard about all of Doug Ford's corruption and stuff like just a year ago. There's plenty of scandals involving all these people, but they're sort of sat on until it becomes politically convenient, which I think undermines the kind of non-political way in which these scandals are used to try to undermine their own political opponents.
Can I just riff off the Trump comparison a little bit here? Because first of all, I want to say that all these Canadians love to shitting on America is like a common is as common a pastime in Canada as suing each other is in the United States. But having said that,
wow, you've included a little bit of a shitting on America.
Yeah,
you like that.
You caught that. Yeah. Okay. So basically, anybody that says, like, looks down on Americans for having elected Donald Trump as president, your foot's in your mouth now, because, like, we elected Ford to the premier of the most populous province here.
But
so,
I'm not from Ontario.
And I want to say that I really think that the processes, the factors behind Donald Trump's win in the United States are exactly the same ones as the factors behind what drove people to the exact same sort of faux populism of Doug Ford, where they don't give a shit about the scandals. They don't care about whether, you know, this guy is like, you know, a walking corruption scandal. It doesn't matter to them. It's the same with Trump. You know, they're pissed off because of very material interests in their life. In the case of Ontario, their hydro bills are through the roof. Their healthcare is getting shittier and shittier. And like, people are just pissed, when someone tells them, like, yeah, I can fix this, it's easy, you know, we just have to like kick out the fat cats and like take care of things like, you know, like real boys do, you know, like in the case of Doug Ford, and like, yeah, a lot of people will just buy that and like, yeah, okay, he's saying he's gonna fix these actual problems I have in my life, I don't care if he's a corrupt dipshit. And there was also a lot of I think both in the case of Ontario and the United States, you have a lot of party loyalty, where there are Republicans in the United States and there are conservatives in Ontario that are going to vote for their party no matter how awful the candidate they put forward is. So I do think that the forces of, you know, post 2008, restructuring of the economy, poor social services, and just like, you know, slow economic malaise and the hollowing out of the manufacturing sector. Exactly the same in both the American case with Trump and the Ontario case with Doug Ford.
That idea of voting for candidate or voting for candidates that they find deplorable or whatever. That's one other thing I've been thinking about is in Canada, what I've seen a few people say out of Ontario, and I don't know how widespread this is, but people, I saw one gay guy talk about how proud he was to elect his local PC candidate. And I was just like, you know, that guy is running under a leader who wants to stop teaching kids about gay people because sex ed is scary and stuff like that. He's like, well, maybe they'll hold him to account in caucus or something like that.
And I think if anything, it'd be the other way around. But
and I think there's this idea that Canadians are good at, because the way our system works is you do just vote for your local representative, unless we get PR here, but that's its own debate. And so I think people can convince themselves when they're voting, oh, I'm voting for Christine Elliott, who seems like your boring conservative who's going to cut some things but not generally run on a hard right social conservative realm. But then they also want to vote against the leader of other parties. So they voted against Kathleen Wynne, but they voted for whoever Joe Tory is. Well, I guess John Tory was a Tory, but Ontario's weird. So they vote for their local MP, who's might be conservative, but they wouldn't vote for the NDP because they think they're activists. I'm still trying to figure parts of this out, but
I don't know if the activism thing is really had as much of a traction as it might have seemed. I think if there was anything in the last week of the campaign that had traction, it was Kathleen Wynne basically saying a vote for Liberals is not a vote for me. Based on the polls and based on the results, that seemed to have been the major shift that occurred in the last portion of the campaign, was that she managed, with her like falling on her own sword, managed to sort of managed to get the Liberal Party up to 7 seats, which isn't anything, but it also managed to keep the NDP out, which probably hurt. Although even then, looking at the way the voter sort of shifts occurred, it tended to be more along the lines of shifting between the PCs and the NDP, and the Liberals kind of just got missed altogether. And I think that kind of comes back to the whole idea that people were looking for an answer to a problem that they were actually facing, which is that, you know, housing is increasingly unaffordable. Healthcare is increasingly dysfunctional. Job opportunities and industry in the province are like anemic and really don't seem to have a clear future. What are we going to do about this stuff? And the sad fact is that Doug Ford was the candidate who had a robust answer to that, all of those questions. Now, his answers were incoherent and in many ways impossible. Like the idea that he would find enough efficiency savings in the healthcare system that he would just use that money to hire more nurses. That, like, these weird sort of, you know, I'm just going to find the money kind of arguments. But that is an actual argument. And the problem is that unless the NDP is willing to come out with like a fairly radical, bold and honestly transformative platform, it's not really able to compete with someone who's just talking out of their hat. Because Doug Ford can promise whatever he wants. And if the alternative is, you know, the NDP going, well, we'll implement dental care. And it's like, great, that's one of the 10 problems I'm facing. What else are you going to do? Like the idea that, let's face it, most of the plans the NDP had, most of the NDP's platform was defensive and like, we're going to put a cap on tuitions. We're going to try to stop the massive increase in rent. And yet those are the things that are, as they currently are, you know, unsustainable, you know, just a pressure on people's lives. I think that that's, from a policy standpoint, the real failing of the NDP consistently, you know, throughout the country, is this inability to provide a robust platform that is actually impacting people's lives. It tends to be, how would I put it, marketing?
Liberal light.
Yeah, well, but also marketing, like I know this is kind of what happens where they'll do polls. What are the issues people care about? And then they'll say, what's an affordable thing we could do that would address each of these issues? You know, people are concerned about healthcare. What if we were to propose a dental program? People are concerned about housing. What if we propose some sort of housing cap or subsidized housing? People can't afford to pay tuitions. Well, what if we were to provide subsidies or caps to that as well? None of these sort of band-aids actually solve the problem, but they do address it. And I think there is at least there is an idea that, hey, this is at least better. But if we can't actually provide a solution to the problems people are facing, then there isn't really any reason to expect the NDP would ever win.
But are the Conservatives actually presenting a solution? Because all they're saying is, we will make these things better with magic. Well,
that is an answer, though. We have the Liberals saying, everything's fine. Ontario's always been great. We're great. It's fine. Whatever. Then NDP going, here's some good things that won't actually fix the problems. And then Doug Ford just kind of waving his arms around and going, I'll fix everything. I'm great. I'll just do it. It'll happen. Don't worry, friends. I'll help you, buddy, pal. You know, I think that that third option, it wasn't decisive, but it does create an environment in which, you know, if I'm going to vote for a candidate, why not vote for the guy who's actually promising to fix these problems? Why settle for someone who is giving me a half measure?
Well, and the default in the Canadian media narratives is always that the Conservatives are more fiscally responsible or whatever. So even when you have they assume, well, they're still going to be worried about deficits and debts and all these important things. And the NDP clearly won't be.
Yeah, and to be fair, deficits and debts are important, but that's usually because, you know, poor people end up paying them. But again, I guess all I can say to sort of the policy angle to the question that we're talking about is just that I think the NDP needs to take a more socialist oriented platform and go forward on that.
Yeah, can I just riff off that a bit? Because, you know, Ian, you just mentioned, like, well, are Doug Ford's solutions that he puts forward to the problems actually going to work? Of course they're not going to work. Are the solutions to the problems that people face, are they being addressed by the Liberals? No, they're not. And that's what causes this, you know, pendulum swing between the Liberals and Conservatives, and, you know, federally and in most provinces, because the NDP is not willing to put forward a radical platform that will actually fundamentally address the structural problems of capitalism that are the main root cause of the problems that people face. And I think that until such time that the NDP is willing to, you know, go all the way and give people an actual solution, then I think that they're going to continue to be kind of an obscure third party.
But then your argument would be that the Communist Party of Canada should be doing much, much better than it is.
Well, there is a distinction to make here, because I do think that, and this is something that's true in the NDP as well, there is an idea that policies are good enough, that the best policies will just win you support. For one thing, I would point out that the Communist Party's actual platform, for the couple dozen people who have ever bothered to read it, isn't actually all that radical, and it also doesn't actually provide very good solutions to the problems people are facing. It's mostly just, you know, Communist Party boilerplate. There's not actually much there. But even if there was, the NDP is still a more dominating political party on the left, which is fine. Like, I don't particularly care which party happens to be the left wing or Labour Party or whatever. But the reason we're talking about the NDP is because it's the one that has a credible chance of actually forming government and implementing policy. That's something, I mean, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, right? You know, how do you get credibility? How do you become a credible party? How do you implement policies? I don't think there's any simple formula or way to do that. In the case of the NDP, there's a base of volunteers, there's connections with unions, there's connections with activists. As it is true that many of the people who run and work in the NDP are dirty, scummy activists. But all of that, and I think from that, you get the you have a base of support, you have a base of popular support. And yeah, the fact that the NDP exists as a political party that's won seats in the past gives it a kind of credibility that, whether it deserves it or not, it'll have going forward. I don't think it's policies that make parties electable in and of themselves. But in the case of the NDP, if they're not going to pick policies that actually address the problems people have, then there actually isn't a reason to vote for them, like from a broad standpoint, right? I mean, I vote for the NDP but in many ways, it's kind of an arbitrary thing. I'm probably going to vote for them next election, regardless of how terrible their platform is. You know, I'm not one of the reasonable voters out there. Whereas a reasonable voter would be looking at a party and going, either what's its platform, what's its history, what's its leader done in the past. And the fact of the matter is that I think on all these points, the NDP tends to be pretty crap. That they're like, we have leaders that have said good things and bad things. We've had leaders, and this is sort of the whole issue, I think, ultimately, when it comes to the NDP, is that we don't actually have a political leadership in the NDP. We have a group of people who are sort of following trends and regurgitating our own opinions back to us and then telling us, isn't this a good idea?
Cool. I was disappointed that Scott wasn't able to come tonight because I wanted to hear the right of center perspective on the NDP, actually.
Yeah,
so
he sends his regrets. Oh. He did want to do it, but his campaign, he's got so many events on.
We'll definitely have to have him on at some point.
Okay, well, since you may be putting this on your podcast, Ian, should we plug our show for 20 yeah. seconds or so?
Yeah, Ben and Mac, tell me about what the Out of Left Field is.
Well, Out of Left Field is a socialist podcast where we have a few beers and talk about either current events or some issue pertinent to current events and the like.
Yeah, we're based in Victoria, Vancouver Island. We're a couple of Marxists, and we like to talk politics. So if you want to tune into our show, that would be wonderful.
Oh, yeah, a lot of fun.
Okay, all cool. Right. Well, thank you for joining us. Listeners, you can find us. Please do subscribe to us and to Politicoast on SoundCloud. And please also follow both of us, Real Ulf, and what is on Twitter? What is your Politicoast handle?
Politicoast is at PoliticoastPod, and my personal handle is iBushfield.
Okay, awesome. And if you want to buy us, or if you want to buy Politicoast a beer, we are both on Patreon, and you can chip in if you want to support the shows. Thank you very much for
capitalist.
Listening. Ian, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
What would you have said?
Yeah, so I thought the general theme that Kevin hit on, that people really are just looking for solutions to problems and aren't really tied to partisan labels as much, and it'll kind of go with the person offering them the solution, even if that person doesn't seem to be particularly good or above board or, you know, not corrupt or not fighting a legal battle with his brother's widow. Like, there's a lot that should have been able to stick against Ford and didn't, because he was just hammering that point home about, I have a solution. We're going to find what $6 billion worth of efficiencies, blah, 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 fits everything. I thought that was a good point that kept getting raised. But what I thought was really missing from the conversation was the talk of kind of where Canadians are generally, and like Canadians, by and large, are fundamentally centrist in their outlooks on a lot of things, but and their voting habits show that, like, in a lot of ways, there is that. And, you know, we'll take peace, order, and good government over the revolution any day.
Yeah, it's really hard to reconcile those two issues or two perspectives. Like, I think a lot of centrists in Ontario are happy, and this is what I think I was trying to get to when I was talking about people voting for their local candidate rather than for Doug Ford, and they went, you know, I have someone who seems moderate in my riding. I'll justify putting Ford as premier by just saying I'm voting for that person. And they feel like it's not a scary change. Whereas the Toronto Sun was telling you there are radicals who hate the police and all these other things in the NDP caucus who are going to be activist-y all over the place, whatever that means.
Yeah, so, and I think that's something that the NDP hasn't really figured out how to engage with. And the typical response in the NDP circle is always, we need to, you know, stand firmer on principle, go more left. And you hear that especially kind of post-2015, especially in the federal NDP. And I'm not sure that's really the right way forward for if they want to win, because, yes, Canadians would like better pharmacare, better health care, you know, cheaper tuition, all of these things, but, you know, they also appreciate a moderate tax rate, not, you know, taxes that don't feel punitive, you know, all of these things that you know, they can work hard, you know, get ahead in the normal system, you know, in the system we've got. And working in that and making it a little better is kind of the way to go. And the NDP putting like really bold changes out there isn't maybe the way to really capture that. And, you know, you can talk a lot about fundamental contradictions in capitalism, but that doesn't connect with Canadians on average. And for that reason, I think it was kind of a mistake to jettison Mulcair. The NDP did not like him post-election, but like, I really think if he'd learned from his mistakes, he could have run a much, like, just tweak what it was there, and he could have absolutely been prime minister, and it was a badly run campaign. It wasn't anything about Mulcair. It was missing a few things just in the general zeitgeist that, you know, it was a change election, people were angry with the Conservatives, and whoever embodied change the most would have won that time. And, you know, Mulcair came out sedate when everybody liked fighter Mulcair. Like, a few things like that.
I've also heard he's duplicitous. But that podcast isn't on the air anymore.
Yes. And, you know, the NDP has typically done best when it's presented itself as a moderate alternative rather than the lefty rabble-rousers. You know, the Jack Layton election in 2011. People shut on Tom Mulcair for losing official opposition status, but we're still the second best seat count ever. The BC NDP here didn't win by going, we're going to nationalize everything.
Well, they didn't win.
They tied.
Right? That's part of the problem, I was approaching the question.
Yeah. And you saw the same thing in Alberta. Like, the NDP, historically, if you actually look at when they have success, it's usually not as the we're going to overthrow the system party. It's the we're the sensible alternative party.
I think the problem in a lot of in Ontario and federally is when you have a Liberal Party, then that is your like responsible progressive change, like not too quick. Yeah. Now, eventually the Liberals are too corrupt to reelect, and then people just go to the Conservatives. So it becomes difficult, but it's an ongoing conversation and there's probably a lot of other things. Well, go check out Out of Left Field podcast if you like that. I'm sure I'll meet those guys in person one time.
Okay, well, moving on to quick takes. There's some follow-up on the World Cup bid that we
Canada
talked about.
Yeah, Canada got it.
Yes.
And BC didn't.
And that is fine, because as we talked about at the time, there was a lot of really questionable terms and conditions in there, and it was basically a blank check to FIFA, which, if you know anything about how FIFA operates, probably isn't the best idea.
It's really interesting watching the people who are really upset by this, because they're like, oh, it's this giant missed opportunity for tourism and all that. And I think it's one thing that the sort of principal Conservatives that I think you more often identify with and the like New Democrats can fully agree on is that corporatist sellouts by government are stupid and we shouldn't do them.
Yes, exactly.
And that's what FIFA is. Only it's worse because it's not just like nationalizing a pipeline and giving money to an oil company that's kind of evil. It's giving money to a fully corrupt organization where its leaders are being arrested. It can't get worse than this. So,
yeah, and I think we're both see it the same way more or less, even if we come at it from slightly different angles, but not everyone did. And there was some pushback on this. And you had the Liberals, because they're in opposition and apparently have to oppose anything no matter how sensible it is, came out against it. And then you also had your soccer fans and...
Well, the BC Liberals were the ones who started the bid process. So it's not too surprising that they're upset. And they were also the ones who brought the Olympics, which is a less corrupt but still kind of corporatist event. It happened to go well.
And in fact, we were kind of the exception on Olympics that go well and actually come out relatively even on the budget, whereas most of them don't. So like being anywhere near the black is surprising for an Olympics. And the fact that we managed to do it should not be an indication that every big sport event's will also work out that way in the future, because if you look at World Cups, if you look at most Olympics, they don't. They end up costing the hosts a lot of money that never gets really recuperated.
Well, if you want to go see the World Cup, you can go to Edmonton or I think Toronto, or just watch it on TV. That's really easier and less drunk hooligan soccer fans. So no big loss. Well, in the ongoing lead up to the electoral referendum, there's a new society that's taken out a front page province ad, and it's a group called fairreferendum.com. And they are a group that say BC deserves a fair referendum that is transparent, free of bias, and doesn't favor a particular outcome. And it's really positioned around a, we're neutral, but we think the question is really bad. And for some reason, they're launching after the question has been announced, which is not an effective time to change it, because the question is being asked in a few months. So this group is being led by children's book author Jim Shepherd. He's more famous for being a past executive of BC Rail and his ties for the BC Liberals, but I'm so excited that I found a Globe and Mail article, I think it was, where they interviewed him, and he was writing a children's book called Adventures of Commander Didlittle and the Lost Battalion. So children's book author Jim Shepherd and BC Liberal insider, sort of tangentially connected person, launches this website, puts a whole bunch of money into these ads, and notes that, oh, until the official campaign starts on July 1st, there's no actual limit on spending. So here's his campaign. Now, he's got a few demands. First, he wants there to be only one question rather than the two-part. He's very confused why there's $500,000 going to the first-past-the-post side and then $500,000 split between the PR sides. So it sounds like he does say...
So would he rather every PR question, like the website, MMP campaign gets...
That's what it kind of sounded like. The website actually seems to suggest, why doesn't MMP, DMP, and Rural Urban all get funding? Because right now someone's advocating for all three. Fine. Let's give another $1 million away to help educate. Then the Liberals, though, will complain that it's three against one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that doesn't make a huge amount of sense.
And then his other complaint is that a system could be decided with less than 50% of the vote, like as low as 34%, if the PR wins, but then most people only like one of these three systems, which is also a very weird critique. I think he doesn't get how instant runoff voting works, maybe. The whole thing is kind of bizarre and seems like people need better things to do with their time and money.
Yeah, it's just yet another attack along the same lines about attacking the process rather than the substance of the referendum.
Well, and I think that's the big thing here is by trying to delegitimize the referendum itself, no matter what the result is, you can then go, well, we shouldn't change it because this whole thing was biased from the start. I've heard Bill Thielman is actually advocating first past the post people not vote, like people who don't want PR, not vote on the second question to try to delegitimize it.
Yeah, that's not going to help. Whatever. If the first question goes in the way of PR, the government isn't going to then say no, because then you'll have like 50% plus of the people going on to vote on the next thing. Like, it's not going to matter that much. And I can't see the NDP backing down on it.
This tries to fuel the confusion, messy narrative. And I guess that's what we're going to deal with for 4 months and not the details of how these systems actually work. I mean, we're actually going to get people on to talk about how these systems work and figure them all out. But, you know, maybe that'll fix the debate.
So I just Googled the guy's book and it sounds amazing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's about a commander has to launch a rescue mission helped by a ghost. And he keeps getting in trouble because he doesn't read his orders. I now kind of want to read that.
Yeah.
But moving on, the former Bank of Canada Governor David Dodge is in the news for promising around the pipeline.
He was speaking at an event in Edmonton put on by a law firm, and the Edmonton Journal reports that he's not just pro-pipeline, but candidly so, let's say. So his comments were, we're going to have some very unpleasant circumstances. There are some people that are going to die in protesting construction of this pipeline. We have to understand that. Nevertheless, we have to be willing to enforce the law once it's there. It's going to take some fortitude to stand up. And, like, you're not supposed to say it.
Also, like, what is the scenario that leads to deaths? It's... I'm actually having trouble picturing the scenario, which is the RCMP isn't that incompetent that they'll just start shooting people to get them out of the way. Like, the police have other methods. Like,
unless he's imagining like suicide bombers or something, but even then, like, people can do nonviolent resistance. He's just implying the army will have to be forced in to push through and we'll have an OCA situation. People will die. Oh, well, the economy goes on. You're not supposed to say it. Like, it's what...
Also, like, the army isn't going to start shooting Canadians either.
It's happened.
Not in modern history.
The OCA crisis.
Yeah, but, like, there was actually, like, gunfire exchange in that, wasn't there? Like, it's...
Yeah.
None of the pipeline protesters have shown up with weapons, so... We are many stages down the road from that ever.
But, like, the point is, even if you take his side fully, there's a way to do policing without people dying. There's a way to enforce the law without people dying. Because we don't have the death penalty in this country. And just like, you know, black people shouldn't be shot in the street. Just like indigenous people shouldn't be shot when they're on their land or, you know, screwing around on someone else's land. People shouldn't be dying. Arrest the people who are protesting. So I haven't seen him walk this back yet, but it's only been, I think this came out earlier today. But yeah, it's just like very raw, and I'm actually surprised he just came out and said it. Because I know there's that like caricature of the evil capitalist who's willing to like literally murder people to build mines and exploit the land. And this fuels that. So we'll keep watching. Maybe we'll see where it goes. But in other economic and trade news, it looks like CETA is under threat again, as this time Italy is pushing back as their new farm minister is worried about how the trade agreement could impact the regional designations Italy has, mainly around their Parmesan cheeses.
Yeah, so I believe we talked about this in our third episode, back when it was the Walloonians standing in the way, and I think everyone kind of figured it was more or less a done deal now that kerfuffle in Belgium got resolved. But yeah, it looks like the Italians are throwing up some resistance
to get
it through. And like, Italy recently has elected a populist government.
I think it's like the five-star party that's...
It's like, yeah.
Far-right, nationalistic.
Yeah, far-right, and there's like an anti-establishment like coalition. I followed Italian politics that closely.
Well, go ask Bill Thielman. He'll tell you all about how PR leads to exactly what Italy just got. So Italy has this angry nationalistic coalition. They don't like free trade or trade period with foreign countries because foreigners. And because of the way the EU is set up, every country has to agree with the trade agreement or it dies. So we'll see.
Yeah, it'd be a shame if it falls apart over this. Although there's a slight irony in Canada losing out on a trade deal because someone's indignant about local agriculture systems. And that has been Politicos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicos.ca. Make sure to subscribe if you ever listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PoliticosPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think to support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politicos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send to us. Thanks for listening.